You're listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Yuhas. My guest today is Dr. Paul Zeitz. He's a physician, an epidemiologist, and an advocate of global justice and human rights. He serves as co-founder of SDG Compacts and the Sustainable Development Games at the Global Development Incubator and the USA Focal Point for Action for Sustainable Development, a global social movement. He is the author of the brand new memoir, Waging Justice, A Doctor's Journey to Speak Truth and Be Bold. And Dr. Zeitz, there's a lot of really impressive people who blurbed your book, and I don't usually read blurbs, but there's so many interesting people on your book that I'm going to go ahead and do it for a moment, because in addition to Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu and Congresswoman Barbara Lee, among a whole host of really impressive people who supported this book, is Alicia Keys, who is not only a wonderful artist and activist, but someone you don't usually see putting her name on a book. And Alicia Keys writes, "I've known Paul since 2001 when we first teamed up in the global fight against HIV/AIDS, and we've worked together ever since. Paul is a driving force in ending the epidemics of AIDS, poverty, and sexual abuse that are raging through the world. This is a book you want to know you have to read. Dr. Zeitz's voice should be heard by everyone." Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Paul Zeitz.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you.
So I wanted to start with that quote from Alicia Keys because it ties together such critically important issues that are carried throughout the book. Fighting the epidemics of AIDS and HIV, poverty, and sexual abuse. And seeing them, of course, as interrelated issues that need to be tackled not in isolation, but together. Tell us stories of then and now. Where the fight, let's start with HIV/AIDS, was when you entered the story on combating it, and where it is now?
Thank you. That's a great question. So I am a doctor. I'm trained in public health and preventive medicine, and I took my career to focus on global health and global infectious disease crises. So I was working on child health and child survival issues, and I got struck during medical school with the fact that 37,000 children died every day from preventable causes at that time. And so through the course of my career, which I describe in the book, I ended up moving myself and my young family to Zambia in southern Africa. When I got there and we were living there, what I experienced was the AIDS Holocaust. I don't know how else to say it, but one out of five people were adults were infected with a killer virus. There was no access to life-saving antiretroviral medications. Literally no one in the country had them, while at the same time these drugs were being made available in the United States, Europe, and Japan. But in sub-Saharan Africa, they were not available. So that meant that adults that were economically productive parents were getting sick for years at a time, and then they were dropping and dying. And that was disrupting families, of course, leaving orphans behind, but it was also destroying communities and institutions, because the capacity gap is severe, and so anyone that was capable was being wiped away. So the book goes into great detail about what was going on in the late 90s in Zambia, and it's was happening all over southern Africa and East Africa. And then I came back to Washington in 2001, and part three of the book is really around the advocacy movement that was created, where there was solidarity between AIDS activists here in the United States and AIDS activists in Africa, and other networks came together and mounted a advocacy movement that led to the creation of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, which were new institutions that mobilized literally billions of dollars per year into the fight in Zambia and other countries. So to answer your question specifically, it's 15 years later since PEPFAR and the Global Fund were launched, and about 50 to 60% of people that are medically eligible for the life-saving AIDS medicines in a country like Zambia are now getting those medicines. So that is a huge leap forward, because most people didn't think it was doable, most people didn't think it was affordable, and most people didn't think that it would be successful. But it is an overwhelming success. So now the efforts are underway. We've made a lot of progress getting to 50 or 60% coverage, but we haven't won the battle against HIV/AIDS in Zambia or other African countries. We need to continue to invest and expand these programs.
Well, and what I was going to jump in and say is one of the things that's so interesting about your memoir is that it really is a book as much about medicine and advances in medicine as it is about activism and social advocacy and the necessity of both taking place at the same time to address these critically important issues that many see as intransigent. And one of the things that when you address the issue of HIV/AIDS, obviously, you know, ACT UP was such a critical player in the United States. But as you point out, real advances came when the U.S. activists also saw their fate and saw their organizing as intimately tied to people all over the world and people dying in particularly horrific numbers on the African continent. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit more and staying with the issue of HIV and AIDS and how that interplay was so important.
Yeah, I think that the ACT UP movement, the AIDS movement, was instrumental in making these life-saving AIDS medicines available to people living in your listening area and across the global north. And in the late 90s, when the data was coming in, that people were starting to see that the epidemic was raging in sub-Saharan Africa, I don't think people understood the scope of it until the late 1990s. And at that point, then, it was really ACT UP, and they formed an organization called the Health Gap Coalition that had strong ties to the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa and other activist networks in sub-Saharan Africa. And it was that solidarity between activists in the global north here in the United States and those African activists that led to the first battles, if you will, to say that every life is of equal value. The lives here in the United States are critically important, and everyone here with HIV deserves these medicines, and the same was true for everyone in Africa. And it was also critically important to move the policy arena here, which I describe in Chapter 3, to have those African voices, those people living with HIV and AIDS, to create a space for them to come and advocate on Capitol Hill and to make their own case for why U.S. support was so critical at that time.
Mm. And talk a little bit more about what it was like to live through those struggles, because you're also on the front lines in terms of seeing so much death and what I'm sure, and as you describe, as unnecessary death. What was it like to watch that the policy take so long to follow the scientific knowledge and, you know, having to watch these very difficult advocacy fights while you're also dealing day in and day out with, you know, I'm sure quite traumatic death.
Yeah, as I was living in Zambia, I was a technical expert working within the U.S. government and within the government of Zambia. And I was driving along the road past the major hospital in the capital of Zambia, Lusaka. It's called the University Teaching Hospital. And the Zambians call it the departure lounge because people go there to die at that time. And I was driving by, and I drive on that road regularly, but I pulled over on the side of the road, parked my car, and I looked in front of me and I wept. And what I saw in front of me was a Christian Aid youth project, and they were selling coffins, both adult size and children size coffins. Mm. And my heart wept. And it was at that moment that I made a commitment to wage justice, and I challenged the status quo. I put forward big, bold ideas that got me in trouble with the U.S. government, then got me in trouble with the U.N. system, and ended up having to leave Zambia, came back to the U.S., and joined forces with other activists to launch the advocacy efforts that led to the breakthroughs that we got with PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan, and the Global Fund.
Can you talk about some of what it meant to have to, you know, to lose on certain fronts to then win on others? Because I think, you know, lots of people, especially right now within the Trump administration, and we even see this, of course, happening, I'm sure, with people who went to Georgetown Prep, as we're talking right now, or people who went to Yale trying to decide should they buck a system that they've been taught if they just play along, you know, they'll get the things that they were expecting at the end. You know, what it was like to make that decision to say, I am going to go against the federal government. I am going to go against the United Nations, even though this was the path that I was supposed to be following.
That is the essence of waging justice for me, mm-hmm. which is that it comes with certain values. It comes with the value of speaking truth, being bold, and serving justice for all. Somehow there was like a wellspring of courage that poured through me that allowed me to just say, I'm not going to be complacent and complicit.
So, you know, I've just obviously alluded to the situation right now with Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and a call that's been put out to men and women who he went to school with in college and men who he went to school with in high school to speak up about what they know about him, if anything, and if it contradicts what he's been saying in public. And one of the issues that you also discuss as interrelated to the HIV/AIDS crisis, also interrelated with poverty, is the issue of sexual abuse. I'm sorry, and poverty as it is interrelated to HIV and AIDS. But another issue, sexual abuse, and how that became an issue that you fought to bring attention to and is also core to understanding and solving public health crises.
Yes. So in the AIDS crisis in Africa, it is a virus that is transmitted from person to person. And it is also a manifestation of racial, economic, and gender injustice. So young girls are predominantly at risk right now. They're the largest group with the greatest burden of disease. And it's because they're forced into sex at a young age in order to survive. So for example, there's data showing that when the school fees are due for girls, when they are starting a semester in basic education, they end up going out on the street and going to the truck stops and selling themselves for money in order to buy uniforms and buy books that they need. And that pattern of sexual abuse was a driver of the epidemic and is still a major problem in many of these countries. So as we learned about HIV and AIDS and the underlying kind of drivers of the disease, interpersonal, physical, and sexual violence is rampant throughout many cultures, including our own here in the United States, but it's also true in Africa and really everywhere in the world. We also were dealing with the fact that a lot of adults were dying prematurely and orphans were being left behind. And the data is showing that there's a large amount of children that are subjected to interpersonal sexual violence from caretakers, school teachers, and other people even within the family, the incest crisis. So my book also shares my own journey with that. As an adult in my late 40s, I had flashbacks and went through a difficult recall of my own experience with early childhood sexual abuse and incest. And I share the story of that revelation and then the healing journey that I'm on even today. And the events in Washington this past month have been extremely important in my view. Mm. And it's an extraordinary courage that Dr. Ford came forward with her testimony, and that has opened up the dike, if you will, and survivors are speaking out and being heard in a transformational way, I hope.
How hard was it for you to share that personal story in your memoir, and why, and thank you for doing so, and why did it feel important to you to do so?
It is extremely difficult for me to share this story. It's scary for me to share it. I feel extremely vulnerable when I talk about the fact that my father sexually assaulted me when I was around 6 or 7 years old. And even saying the word incest is a very hard word to say. And I felt like there was a story within me that I had to tell. I had to share this story because I don't think any child or any person should go through what I've gone through. The turmoil, the pain, the suffering, it's wrong. And it's 1 out of 6 boys. It's 1 out of 3 girls here in the United States. Literally millions of people have gone through some kind of sexual abuse as a child. And then on top of that, all the sexual assault that's happening. And it's traumatizing and wounding. And I think it's a critical element of addiction and mental health crises that are going on in our culture and globally. And I think we have an opportunity now to be a generation that reveals what's actually going on so that we can heal together.
Well, I think that's such a critically important word, which is healing. And, the attempt to heal through addressing these traumas. And, you know, as you tell in the book, one of the first steps was simply exposing the reality of childhood sexual assault and abuse within the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and how difficult just that first step was. How far along down that path are we now in terms of understanding that that's a key part of this public health crisis and addressing it through that other factor that I've been bringing up and that you mentioned in the book, you know, addressing poverty as well as.
So there's two parts to that. In terms of the violence against women and children, I think that since I was living in Africa, it's now 20 some years later, there's been a huge transformation in terms of our understanding of the problem and efforts to combat it. Tomorrow in New York, for the first time, the Economist Intelligence Unit is going to be publishing an index rating 40 countries on their response to child sexual abuse. That kind of data has never been available for. So they're being benchmarked and compared in terms of the problem and what the response is. And the UN system and governments around the world now are doing what are called violence against children surveys. These are household surveys that are happening in about 20 countries right now. For the first time in the last 5 years, these surveys have been mounted. And then the data is used to mount a national response to reform the education system and make sure that the health system is ready to take forensic evidence. And then the criminal justice system has to be activated to mount a response. So to change the culture and create child sexual abuse free zones, you need to have a comprehensive response.
So then as another factor is addressing the issue of poverty, which is not necessarily typically looked at as the job of a doctor, but you know, the necessity of also addressing poverty when we're looking at, in particular, starting with HIV and AIDS.
So I believe that the efforts to combat these infectious diseases have been enabling the economic renaissance that's underway in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. So if you're allowing people to live healthy lives and not be sick from malaria or die from HIV, AIDS, then they're able to contribute to their society. And we're seeing many countries have positive trends in economic growth throughout Africa. And I think the investments by the United States and other wealthy countries to support this health renaissance has enabled an economic renaissance in Africa and other parts of the world.
I think it's an important issue that you bring up, this halving of deaths by 3 million lives saved on TB, malaria, and HIV AIDS is this an incredible success story of these combination of factors that you've discussed, the medicine, the science, the activism, the advocacy, and the policy coming together to, you know, really save millions of lives. And what do you foresee in terms of the increased health risks associated with climate change, with the mass movements of people, specifically in terms of acknowledging the impact on public health as a particular outcome of climate change?
Yeah, so as in the similar way that HIV disproportionately affects people living in poverty, people of color, these are the communities that are living in the most vulnerable areas, you know, by the waterways, by the coastal areas where the storms are getting more intense. The Arab Spring, for example, in North Africa and the Middle East was directly attributable to an extended drought that was underway in that part of the world. So all the turmoil that we're seeing in the Middle East is in part contributed to by the climate crisis. So the whole refugee crisis that is underway right now coming from Syria and the Middle East, of course, there were other factors like ISIS and the Syrian government's the dynamics there. But an underlying driver of that instability is the climate crisis. So I think we're just beginning to see how that will destabilize communities and governments if we don't step up now and take bold and aggressive action to mitigate the impact.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to share your work with us. My guest is Dr. Paul Zeitz, a physician and epidemiologist and an advocate for global justice and human rights. His brand new memoir just out is called Waging Justice, A Doctor's Journey to Speak Truth and Be Bold. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you.